Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us in this hour, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We're going to talk about international human rights, Christian apologetics, the war in Iraq, and the war on terrorism. Some of the subjects we'll talk about in particular is the arrest of Abu Hamza al-Masri in London. This is a Islamic cleric who is the imam of the Finsbury Park Mosque that's been linked to September 11th terrorism and other acts of terrorism as well. He was arrested, and the United States is seeking his extradition from Great Britain on some of these. It's an 11-count indictment with hostage-taking and conspiracy in connection with the December 1998 indictment that killed four tourists in Yemen. We're going to be talking about that as well as the goings-on at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq and the war in Iraq and the war on terrorism. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He is also a distinguished professor of apologetics in the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He has authored and edited more than 50 books, including Human Rights and Human Dignity, and he is kind enough to join us here on Issues Etc. Dr. Montgomery, welcome back.
Always a pleasure.
The story about Abu Hamza al-Masri, this London cleric who apparently has ties to terrorism internationally, has been arrested, and the United States is seeking his indictment, perhaps, and this is what's holding up the indictment, extradition, perhaps on charges that could land him with the death penalty. Your reaction to this story?
Well, he is a dreadful problem over here, and that mosque has been a focal center for all sorts of terrorist activity. There's no question about that. There are associations with 9/11 terrorists and others, and it's a perfect example of the fact that if the obnoxious Islamic principles are allowed to be presented in a democratic society, you're going to have difficulties like this. At the same time, extradition to the United States may well pose a problem, and the reason for this is that in Europe, by way of the European Convention of Human Rights, the death penalty is a no-no. One must not do this. And therefore, unless the U.S. Pledges that were he to be extradited, he will not suffer capital punishment, there will be no extradition.
Now, what would you expect? You are very familiar, of course, with what's going on in Great Britain and with its legal system. What would you expect Great Britain to do with this cleric?
Well, I think that if there's an extradition request presented by the U.S., then Great Britain will require a condition for the extradition, and the condition will be that the death penalty will not be exercised against him. And if the U.S. is willing to pledge that, then there might well be an extradition. I think that Great Britain would be delighted to have him out of here, and therefore this would be an advantage, but they're not going to violate the European Convention on Human Rights by allowing an extradition which would result in his execution.
Now, this is, of course, coming at a time when there is a heightened threat in the United States over unspecified plans being made by Al-Qaeda. I think that's the name that's actually being used for something this summer. That's about all the more we're hearing about it. It also comes upon the heels of 6 weeks of stories out of Iraq. Not only do they have cleric problems there in Iraq with one in Najaf that seems to be thumbing his nose at the United States, but also the U.S. Forces over there, at least at Abu Ghraib prison, have not been on their best behavior as well. Your reaction to the Abu Ghraib stories?
The actions of American military personnel in Iraq have caused more difficulties for the coalition than any other single thing. It is absolutely incredible that American soldiers would have subjected the prisoners to the kind of treatment that they have. And they have on their heads the responsibility for a collapse of everything that's been done. It is just a damnable business. The British and people in Europe have been thoroughly offended by this, and of course it's given exactly the ammunition to the Arab countries that they've been looking for. It's hard to comprehend how American military personnel could have engaged in activities like this with impunity.
Now, one of the rationale that has been put forth, not by anyone who has any responsibility for this, but this is speculation that flies in every direction over here, these actions that we see depicted in tape and on pictures from Abu Ghraib were part of a systematic tactic in order to soften up these prisoners for the extraction of information under interrogation. What do you make of that?
Well, that may well be the motive for it, but there are humanitarian limits to what you can do in order to get information. It either says that the American forces were too stupid to figure out means of getting this information that would not violate international norms and humanitarian rights, or they simply went ahead anyway. There's no justification whatsoever for this sort of thing, and it's so sad because the credibility of the coalition has been lowered to an incredible extent as a result of this.
Is it conceivable to you that the soldiers and the commanders who had direct responsibility over Abu Ghraib prison were less than aware or unaware of the Geneva Conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners during a time of war?
Well, it's hard to believe this because that is so fundamental. It's hard for me to believe that they wouldn't have been presented with this before they came over here. I mean, that wouldn't have taken 1 hour to present them with the protections that exist for prisoners under those conditions. I can only conclude that this was a lack of adequate supervision by their superiors, and the feeling that in some way the end justified the means, because the Muslims had handled the situation so miserably that therefore they could do anything to the prisoners that they wanted to. But my goodness, I mean, that's the kind of attitude that existed among the Nazis during the Second World War. Whenever the average soldier was confronted by what he had done, he would always say, well, nobody stopped me, or this was the fault of my supervisors, the officers over me.
What do you make of those who are saying, look, if you compare what took place in the year there since the United States has been in charge of Abu Ghraib with the 25 previous years, or however long Abu Ghraib stood under Saddam Hussein's rule, what happened there under the Americans pales by comparison. Why are we making such a big deal out of this? How do you respond?
Well, of course it pales in the sense that that Hussein was a miserable dictator who caused incredible problems for his people and slaughtered vast numbers, but two wrongs don't happen to make a right. It is still the case that if you are dealing with a damnable dictator, you don't want to descend to his level and engage in the same kind of conduct on a lesser scale and then try to justify it by the fact that he did worse things than you've done.
And the same comparison is being made, or a similar line is being drawn between the murder, mutilation, burning, and public display of the burned bodies of those four civilians on the bridge. Of course, everyone saw those pictures, saying, look what they're doing to us. Why are we worried about Abu Ghraib?
Well, we're worried because we are, presumably, a democratic civilization based upon biblical ideals on transcendent values, whereas that regime happens to be a miserable, primitive, uncivilized operation with absolutely no respect for human life. And if we give even the suggestion that we have accepted those values, we lose the credibility for the position that we maintain. This question has been raised in philosophy of law and in philosophy in general for centuries. Can a democratic regime or can a Christian regime employ the same techniques that a non-democratic, totalitarian, non-Christian regime uses in order to prevent that regime from gaining control? And, of course, the answer is no, because if you descend to the level of what they have done in order to preserve your regime, you turn into exactly the same kind of regime that you're trying to eliminate. We are, in a sense, limited in what we can do as compared with a demonic operation. We cannot descend to those levels, and if we do, the result of this is going to be that we will lose the very nature of our ideals for which we are fighting in the first place.
Particular first and then general in a moment, Dr. Montgomery, what has Abu Ghraib done for the support of the war in Great Britain, in the greater European Union there, and how does that compare with how it would be if we wouldn't have had an Abu Ghraib kind of an expose?
Well, if we hadn't had that, then the argument that the U.S. is functioning as an international policeman to eliminate inhumanity and violations of human rights would have existed as a really sound case. And that was the best argument that we had against those countries, such as France and Germany, that didn't want us to intervene in the first place. The worst aspect of what has occurred is that it has fed the arguments against our ever having gone there in the first place. You know, at the present time, the U.S. is the most powerful country on earth and had a sense of moral superiority such that it could intervene in these situations worldwide. Now, it's very, very difficult for the U.S. to present that kind of argument because it looks as if the U.S. is on the same level as those that we're trying to eliminate.
We're talking about international human rights, Christian apologetics, the war in Iraq, and the war on terrorism with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Feel free to join us with a question or a comment, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Much on the minds of everyone over here, Dr. Montgomery, is the so-called June 30th deadline. I guess more technically, it is the June 30th transfer of power. What do you realistically expect to happen in Iraq on and after June 30th?
Well, there's been so much political pressure now upon the U.S. and the U.K. that both countries are desperate to get out of the situation. But, of course, they don't want to get out of it, leaving the situation as if they had not accomplished anything. My expectation is that there will indeed be a withdrawal, but it will be a withdrawal of a political nature, which will nevertheless leave the essential military forces in place so that there cannot be a reversion to what existed before. We hope and we pray that that will be the result, because if after that date the end result is that Iraq blows up, or it turns out to be the creation of another Islamic State, or in some way the forces behind Saddam recover power, then everything that's been done will have gone to waste, and it will absolutely condemn any kind of intervention. The thing that frightens me is that there could very well be a situation where, like in Vietnam, the U.S. will be so horrified by everything that's happened that it will just withdraw from the world scene and allow everything to go to hell without being willing to intervene. My philosophy is that the U.S. has been in a position, owing to its Christian roots, to do something about the human rights violations worldwide. I want the U.S. to be an international policeman, but if it's going to be a policeman that can't restrain itself, then, of course, it's not going to be able to function in that way.
How, legally, how do you do June 30th? How do you set up and enact a transfer of power given these circumstances? I mean, do you get people together? You say, okay, you're in charge. Sign the contract. This is what we expect of you. And we're sticking around to make sure everything goes well. How does
that
happen?
Well, it's more or less like that. But, of course, what the U.S. really wants is to have this occur under a U.N. umbrella so that if there is any question about the legitimacy of the whole thing, the U.N. will have put its stamp of approval on it. The awkward part of that is, of course, that when the U.S. went in, It went in under a UN resolution, but not under the resolution that the UN wanted. So now it's possible for France and Germany to say, well, it's a fine state of affairs. Now the U.S. wants the UN to operate, and it didn't want the UN to operate previously. This is really messy. I trust that the UN will create a kind of sanction for the transfer of power. And if that's the case, then if people scream subsequently, they will be appealing to the UN to enforce this.
Our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, has authored and edited more than 50 books, including Human Rights and Human Dignity. You can purchase this book and several of Dr. Montgomery's other books through the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy. Their website, www.ciltpp.com. CILTPP.com, or you can call them at area code 780-461-3076. That's 780 area code 461-3076. Dr. Montgomery, so when we use the word sovereignty, Iraqi sovereignty, that is going to be kind of a unfolding reality during the summer and the months, or perhaps even the years to come.
Yes. The country is, of course, a nation in its own right, and the only reason that they have not been able to maintain their own position as a nation is because of the dictatorial conduct of their previous leader. And once they are given back their right to operate, then they can determine their own destiny. And, of course, that's awkward, and the U.S. wants to make sure, U.S. and Britain want to make sure that there is a democratic structure in operation so that there will be genuine elections and so that a single group that would eliminate democracy doesn't gain control. And this is very awkward because in the Near East, especially in Muslim countries, democracy has never been a high value. I mean, in the other Muslim countries of the Near East, those with whom we have not had great difficulties, Saudi Arabia and the like, the fact is that those countries are in the hands of dictators. They are monarchical operations, traditional hereditary monarchies, this is not at all the kind of society that we would favor. The only difference with Iraq is that they haven't been boiling their own citizens in oil the way Saddam did.
Is it too much to ask whether or not democracy is even possible, not only for Iraq, just because it's Iraq, but for Iraq because it is and will be a Muslim state?
Well, the fact is that Islam in no way promotes or even tolerates democracy. Anyone who understands the history of Islam sees a history of caliphs and other dictatorial, autocratic, centralized folk simply telling an uneducated populace how to operate. I realize this is not politically correct, but the fact of the matter is that Islam is one of the least attractive religions in world history. And if democracy prevails in that area, it'll be in spite of Islam, not because of it. When Islam is in power, when it's a majority operation in a country, there is always oppression of other viewpoints, because Islam holds that any kind of apostasy, any removal from Islam, is not only a sin, but it's a crime, and it's often punished capitally. When, however, Islam is a minority, of course, they want to have all of the freedoms that any democracy would allow. The only Islamic country in the world that has created and sustained a democracy is Turkey. And the only reason for this is that Ataturk, back in the 1920s, insisted on a secular state. Technically, Turkey is a secular state, and they will not allow Islamic parties to maintain control. There was a case at the European Court of Human Rights where an extremist Islamic party wanted to be president of an election in Turkey, and the government wouldn't allow it. And the party went to the European Court of Human Rights, and the European Court said, listen, if they became the controlling power, they would eliminate all democracy, and therefore you can't expect the European Court of Human Rights to support a party that would destroy the European Convention on Human Rights. Turkey operates as a democratic country in a sense only because it's a secular country in which Islam has not been allowed to maintain control. And I had contact personally with the late president of Egypt, and I was at his home in Aswan years ago before he was assassinated. He was assassinated by Islamic extremists who didn't want Egypt to operate as a democratic Western country.
Dr. Montgomery, would you be willing to stay on after the break? I'd like to go more in-depth into this whole issue of Islam and human rights.
Oh, I do anything you want. You know that.
One more question. I read today that in Turkey there is an educational reform bill that would give preferential treatment to Muslims in their choice of a school to study in higher education. And the secularists in the country are saying, no, this would head us backward toward an Islamic state. Is that exactly the kind of thing you're talking about?
That's not quite the case. The proposal is that they be allowed, finally, to enter higher education. Turkey has been so suspicious of the Muslim extremists that they have not allowed people who go to strictly Muslim schools to enter public education.
Okay.
And now the opportunity is going to be given for them to do this. I'm not sure that there's any problem with that, but it reinforces the point that I'm making, that Turkey has tried desperately to repress any kind of Muslim extremism, and that's why Turkey is so different from all of the other countries with a Muslim majority in the Near East.
You are an international human rights attorney. We've got 1 minute before this break, and we'll pick it up on the other side. Tell us about the state of human rights in Muslim countries. How would you paint the picture in a paragraph or two?
It's misery. It doesn't even require a paragraph. It's misery. Women don't have the same rights as men. The religious freedom doesn't exist. No Muslim country has been willing to affirm the principle of religious freedom or the right to change one's religion that appears in the European Convention on Human Rights. If you want human rights, you do not want Islam.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. Feel free to join us as we talk about international human rights, Christian apologetics, the war on Iraq, and the war on terrorism. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, we're going to talk about it's a tripartite Iraq, no matter how you cut it. In the north, you've got the Kurds. In the middle, you've got the Sunni Muslims. In the south, you have the Shiite majority. How do we deal with that in an Iraq post-war? Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He is distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, an author and editor of more than 50 books, including Human Rights and Human Dignity. If you prefer, you can also email us live here in the studio at issuesetc@kfuo.org or call us as we talk with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What is Lutheran theology really all about? Is it about the Lutheran Reformation? Is it about not being a Roman Catholic? Is it about Martin Luther? No, Lutheran theology is really all about Jesus. Learn more in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center by Pastor Daniel Preuss. You can order Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or learn more about our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, by visiting our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find out more about our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The number of alcohol ads on television is soaring. At the same time, ads urging responsible drinking are dropping drastically. Watchdog groups warn that's sending the wrong message to young people. Stuart Shepard reports.
Alcohol ads on TV outnumbered responsibility ads by a ratio of 226 to 1, according to the Center for Alcohol Marketing at Georgetown University. Product ads increased by nearly 40% from 01 to 02, study author David Jernigan.
They spent about $990 million on product ads and about $10 million on responsibility ads.
And those product ads regularly feature stars popular with teens, such as this football-themed ad with rapper Kid Rock.
On TV, kids are drowning in product ads, and literally an avalanche of product advertising and a trickle of messages about the dangers or potential consequences from alcohol use.
He says the best way to bring some balance would be a national ad campaign that tells about the dangers of underage drinking.
We're talking about ads that are not made by the alcohol industry, because even the responsibility ads have their logo and their mark on them.
Wendy Hamilton is president of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. She says those ads should target adults, since that's where most underage drinkers get alcohol.
We feel that this would help to make a difference in changing attitudes with certainly adults in helping to keep alcohol away from young people.
She says the best source for those ads would be the federal government. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
The study noted 290,000 alcohol product ads in 02. It also found that on a per capita basis, young people were more likely than adults to be exposed to alcohol advertising on TV. The reason, the 15 TV shows that were most popular with teens all carried alcohol advertising. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Hi, I'm Pastor Doug Nicely. Before he ascended into heaven, Jesus told his disciples, "But you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth." What he said was very radical. We'll talk a little bit about what that means in the context of Pentecost this week on In His Steps.
Listen to In His Steps, Saturday at noon with Pastor Doug Nicely on AM 850 KFUO.
Our Issues Etc. book of the month for May is Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Daniel Preuss. You can find out more on our website, issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section, or you can call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. The title again, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. Now, Dr. Montgomery and I are both Lutherans. We're not the only ones, of course, but perhaps two of the best, I guess. Why are we two people of completely divergent calibers and people of completely divergent experience? Why are we Lutherans? The answer is simple. At the center of all Lutheran teaching and practice stands Christ and Him crucified for the sinner. It is Christ-centered cross focused theology. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for May, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center, is by another Lutheran, Pastor Daniel Preuss, a regular guest also here on Issues Etc. The book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it from Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section for the book, Why I Am a Lutheran, Jesus at the Center. Dr. Montgomery, back to the issue of Islam and human rights. It's a complex picture here in Iraq. In the north, there are the Kurds who have wanted independence forever. It is in the middle, there are the Sunni who stand as the minority, but the former power holders there through Saddam Hussein of the Ba'athist Party. And then in the south, there is the Shiite majority. How do we sort this out in a post-war Iraq?
Well, that's not easy. What's necessary, of course, is to have a constitution that guarantees various rights that cannot be altered easily by a majoritarian rule. The whole purpose of a constitution is to make sure that certain rights stand beyond the reach of legislatures that can be very much prejudiced and reflect a majority of the people, but against rights that are very important. And that kind of notion has been foreign to any Islamic state. Islamic states have been totalitarian, as we said before the break. They have gone along with whatever the ruling party or ruling family has happened to want, or they have reflected the majoritarian religious party and therefore have repressed parties that are in the minority. So what we have to do is to have a constitution in Iraq that makes certain that the majority cannot grind down on the minorities. The Shiites, given half the chance, would make life utterly miserable for everybody else. But then again, the Sunnis made life miserable for everybody else by way of Saddam. These are the two Islamic parties. The Kurds are an ethnic people, and they are not Iraqi. There is a Kurdish population in Iraq, Iran, and Turkey. When I did Ararat exploration back in the 1970s, I had a great deal of contact with Kurds that were in eastern Turkey, close to the Russian border. And these people did not want to have anything to do with the Islamic peoples of Turkey or of those other countries. The Kurds tend to be Islam in their belief, but they are first of all Kurds. So we don't want to have the Shiites grind down on them any more than we wanted to have the Sunnis grind down on them.
I was talking recently with another guest, and he suggested that there is an individual. He's actually of the Iraqi royal family. He's been living in London and he's a London economist. Sharif al-Hussein is his name, just by coincidence. He is a Sunni. He's a 48th generation descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. Apparently a rather intelligent man, and just by way of speculation said, you know, this is the kind of person who could perhaps, although he is a Sunni, he is a descendant of the Prophet, and has been living in exile, could perhaps be one of those kind of unifying leaders, but he was suggesting under a constitutional monarchy. Would that be even a possibility?
Well, that's very interesting, because in the London Times today, there is a front-page picture of that gentleman, and the article suggests that he has the greatest opportunity to become Iraq's first post-war prime minister. He was a professor of science at the University of Surrey, therefore, of course, he is very comfortable from the standpoint of the U.K., this is quite interesting. I will read you, in fact, from the front page of the Times today. Hussein al-Sharisti is regarded as one of the most courageous and principled figures of his generation. A political novice, but his relative obscurity, his academic background, and moderate views are precisely the qualities that are being sought in whoever takes the helm on June 30th. He is actually not Sunni, he is Shiite. He's a devout Shia Muslim is a confidant of the influential spiritual leader Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, but he's also an advocate of creating a secular state in Iraq. In other words, he would try to do in Iraq what was done in Turkey back in the 1920s.
Do you get the impression that the coalition forces are still shopping around for someone to take the reins?
Oh, sure they are. Sure they are. And this gentleman would be ideal in the sense that he has enough contact with the West that the West can be confident that he has picked up Western values. At the same time, since he is a Muslim and since he has connections in Iraq, he would be able to gain the confidence of people there.
There remains, not only there but elsewhere in the Islamic world, what I have come to think of as the cleric problem, which is that the man on the street, if he is going, if he's attending the mosque, and even if there isn't Sharia law requiring him to do so, will be getting a lot of his information, a lot of his motivation, a lot of his way of thinking from whoever happens to preach at the local mosque.
Oh, this is absolutely correct. The closest parallel in the West is in the Middle Ages, where you had an utterly ignorant, uneducated populace, and the priest, the Roman Catholic priest, simply declared what was the truth, and people would accept no matter what he said. And this is precisely what you have in Islamic countries. The level of education is so low that that the priest is regarded as a kind of demigod, and the imam, and he is anything he says is taken as true. This reminds me of the old story, which is frequently recounted theologically, that someone said to the peasant, "What do you believe?" And the peasant said, "I believe whatever the priest believes." And so then one goes to the priest and one says, "What do you believe?" He says, "Oh," he says, "I believe whatever the bishop says." And then you go to the bishop and the bishop says, "I believe whatever the pope says." And you go to the pope and you ask him and he says, "That's none of your business."
That is a good one.
"I'm the pope." I mean, this is the problem of authoritarianism everywhere. And this is why, by the way, historic evangelical Christianity has it all over that sort of thing. Because in historic evangelical Christianity, you go to the scriptures. Why? Because they are provably, demonstrably, the Word of God. Christ has declared himself, he has died for your sins, he has risen again, there is solid evidence for this, and he places his stamp of approval upon the scriptures. So then, you can trust what God says, and if somebody comes along and says anything to the contrary, you tell him to go jump in the lake. No matter what his authoritative position is in some organization.
So this is going to be an ongoing problem. It sounds as though Turkey has managed to manage Islam only by managing the voice of Islam, that is the mosque, and what comes out of it, what people do act upon the things that come out of it. Will Iraq have to essentially do the same thing, manage Islam in order to have anything approaching democracy?
Oh, very definitely. And the question is whether that can work there. Because in the case of Turkey, there wasn't the international pressure at the time that the secular state was established. When Ataturk did this, he did this internally, and he did it largely through having the military on his side. And even today, behind every Turkish government has been the force of the military. The difficulty in Iraq is that there isn't that kind of atmosphere. You've got all of the international pressures, and you don't have a military which is aligned with a single figure who would establish this kind of secular state. Without some sort of internal force to achieve this, it's very hard to know what will happen. I mean, it may well be that the country is so divided and so diverse in its interests that the whole thing will simply blow apart. I must say that much as I was in favor of the intervention to get rid of Saddam, it would have been nice if the U.S. had had a little bit more understanding of what was cooking there. I have this awful feeling that when the U.S. goes into other areas, it goes in with a lack of the kind of understanding of local conditions that's so important. I've noticed this with American tourists. They don't know one end from up when they turn up in Europe. They have no historical background. They don't understand the customs or the people or the language or anything, and yet with a kind of arrogance, they figure that they can easily function over here. I wonder if this may not be a problem. I want the U.S. to be an international policeman because of its values, but I'd like it to be a sensitive, you know, reasonably intelligent international policeman. I don't think that's asking too much.
Can the United States, we talk about whether or not the United States should be an international policeman, but given its place in the world today, especially post-Cold War world today, or maybe we should just talk about a different kind of a Cold War, but post-Soviet Cold War bloc United States, can it avoid being an international policeman?
I don't think there's any way to avoid this. And therefore, I guess my plea would be, you know, the Europeans regard Americans as adolescents, not only because the country has only a 200-year history, but also because of the rather adolescent approach to life that's taken by so many Americans, the lack of maturity, of an understanding of history and all that. I guess my desire would be not that America be less of a policeman, but that it be a more mature policeman, and that Americans would get a better understanding of history and of other countries and a greater sense of the international, and from a Christian standpoint, a greater realization that every country consists of creatures of God who need to be understood and appreciated. I think it's on that level that America has its biggest difficulty. You know that book years ago, The Ugly American? This is the American who goes out in a bombastic fashion and expects everybody to treat him nicely and has no respect for anybody else. Now, that's the kind of thing that has to be eliminated. And that's, of course, the source of those tortures that were carried on by the military in Iraq.
Could this not only be a fatal flaw leading to incompetence, but a fatal flaw leading to failure or even worse, disaster, this attitude?
Oh, sure it can. And it's done this. It's created disaster in personal relationships. I was once in a situation where a wretched American tourist started insulting someone in a line, in a queue in France, and the end result of this was that everybody was held up. There were all sorts of problems, and I thought to myself, you know, that kind of imbecile should not be allowed outside of the country. And if that can happen on an individual basis, this was a person who thought that because he didn't know the language, if he just yelled loud enough, people would understand him. You know, that somehow raising the tone of his voice would take care of the problem. I mean, if that kind of attitude prevails, you can imagine, multiplied on a political level, what it could do.
We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, French advocate, barrister at law in England and Wales, member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, author and editor of more than 50 books, including Human Rights and Human Dignity. We're talking about international human rights, the war in Iraq, and the war on terrorism. You can join us, please do, in the final minutes of our conversation with Dr. Montgomery, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, or email us at issuesetc@kfuo.org. Very recently, the President of the United States gave an address at the War College. It was nationally televised, although not carried on the network television. It was nationally televised here this last week. And I want your reaction to two things that he had to say, Dr. Montgomery. It plays into what we've been talking about before. Near the end of this address, the president outlined, basically drew a picture of our enemy. It's a rather lengthy quote. I want you to pay in particular attention to his final statements here. Our terrorist enemies have a vision that guides and explains all their varied acts of murder. They seek to impose Taliban-like rule country by country across the greater Middle East. They seek the control of every person, mind, soul, a harsh society in which women are voiceless and brutalized. They seek bases of operation to train more killers and export more violence. They commit dramatic acts of murder to shock, frighten, and demoralize civilized nations, hoping we will retreat and give them free rein. They seek weapons of mass destruction to impose their will through blackmail and catastrophic attacks. And this is the point to which I want your reaction. None of this is the expression of a religion. It is a totalitarian political ideology pursued with consuming zeal and without conscience. What do you make of the president's assessment of the relationship of Islam
to these things? Everything up to the last sentence was quite correct. But the question is, where does the totalitarian ideology come from? I mean, this doesn't appear out of nowhere. The reason for the totalitarian ideology is, of course, their religious convictions. If you look at every one of the acts of terrorism that have taken place from 9/11 right on through, all of them have been directly related by the perpetrators of them to Islam. Every one. None of them has been presented as an independent totalitarian objection to the West. And it seems to me that we ought to listen to those who are engaged in this activity. They tell us that this is the fruits of Islam. What they're doing is carrying out the will of Allah. All right, fine. I mean, we're not imposing that interpretation on them. And I understand that the president is desperate not to appear as a religious bigot, and we are drowned with in the seas of tolerance today, where we have to say something nice, I suppose, about cannibalism and the Third Reich. I don't know, but it looks to me as if there are certain ideologies that are, quite frankly, damnable. These ideologies, if allowed to prevail, will produce totalitarianism. And I don't understand why we can't recognize this. I mean, to recognize this is simply to go with the facts.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Gwen is calling from St. Louis. Gwen, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to ask him, in Paris earlier this year, they had a proposed law to ban religious symbols from the French public schools, and it was thousands of Muslims were protesting that, but I never heard the results of that. What happened in that? I'll hang up and listen.
Gwen, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Dr. Montgomery.
Okay. Actually, this law was to prohibit students in the public schools from displaying demonstrable religious symbols. It would not prevent you from wearing a cross around your neck, but the purpose of it was to prevent people from going in religious dress into the public schools. For example, and particularly the Muslim students from wearing the headdress and the robes, which would separate them from other students. And that was passed, by the way, by both the lower and the upper house of the French Parliament. So that is now a law. And it reflects the situation that existed earlier, that it was not possible to wear the Muslim headdress in any public function. And there have been instances in France where Muslim women have insisted on wearing their headdress and their veil and that sort of thing, and they have been discharged from public functions, and that has been upheld by the Cour de Cassation, the Supreme Court in France. The French philosophy is that you've got to have a level playing field in the state, and you cannot have any one body of belief create such an evident presence that it could disrupt the state as such. I have no problems with this. I think this is perfectly all right. I don't think that any religious group should be in a position to control a country or to influence a country in such a way that other people feel uncomfortable. No religious group should be able to polarize a country. And it's very interesting that France takes that view.
As our time winds down, let's talk with Monica calling from Swansea. Monica, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Dr. Montgomery, I was in Paris this past Christmas and New Year's.
What a privilege.
It was wonderful. But we had left and returned to the country the day after New Year's in France, and we walked the Champs-Élysées from the Louvre all the way down the Champs-Élysées, and the place was busted out with glass and just kicked in and damaged and vandalized from one end to the other. I was told by the man at our bed breakfast that it was Muslims that did this on New Year's Eve. Is that true?
Thank you, Monica.
I don't know about that. I didn't happen to be in Paris at Christmas time. We stayed here in England at Christmas, and I didn't read anything about that in the papers. The Champs-Élysées consists of quite sophisticated shops. Are you saying that the windows of these shops were broken?
Yeah, it sounds as though that's what she was saying, yes.
Yeah, well, as I say, I didn't hear of this, and I'm sure, you know, had it been awfully extensive, this would have gotten into the British papers. The English just love anything that they can point out that hasn't been going right in France. They've been doing this since the Middle Ages. But look, the fact of the matter is that you can expect among people of Muslim belief, if they are fanatical, a disregard for the rule of law in relation to Western democracies. And this may well have been a reaction to the restriction on Muslim dress in the public schools. Could well be. But as I say, I don't know. I didn't read anything about that. And we're in France, goodness, almost every other month. And my son and daughter-in-law are there. And it's strange that we didn't hear about that.
Dr. Montgomery, with only 1 minute to respond, compare the truth claims of Christianity to those of Islam. 1 minute, please.
Well, that's easy and can be done in 1 minute. There is absolutely no evidence for the claim that Muhammad made that he was the prophet of God and the Quran came from God. I mean, I could claim this for my own writings, and they probably would sell better. That's all there is. There is absolutely no evidence that he was a unique prophet of God. In the case of Christianity, you have Jesus who predicted his death and resurrection, and you have the Old Testament prophecies concerning this, and then you have the eyewitness evidence that he did, in fact, rise again from the dead. And Jesus placed a stamp of approval on the Old Testament. He predicted the New Testament would be written by his apostles and follow his teachings. And so in the case of Christianity, you've got a solid evidential base for belief. This is not credulity. If you believe in Christianity, you're basing this on what actually happened. You're not simply going along with someone who claims that what he says is true.
Our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, is a director and professor in residence for the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, which is held annually in Strasbourg, France. Now, it's too late to attend this summer's Academy, but you can register early for 2005. If you'd like a free information brochure on the 9th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, simply call 1-800-737-0172, and we'll send you a free brochure. Dr. Montgomery, thank you very much for being our guest.
Always a pleasure.
That number, 1-800-737-0172. By the way, folks, I'm on vacation next week. We're going to replay our series with Dr. Montgomery on testing the truth claims of Christianity during that week. When we come back from this break, Suzanne Venker joins us for our latest in our series on working mothers.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.